The Cuckoo's Calling by Robert Galbraith. Prologue. Is daemon miser est, cuius nobilitas miserias nobilitat. Unhappy is he whose fame makes his misfortunes famous. Lucius Accius, Telephus. The buzz in the street was like the humming of flies. Photographers stood massed behind barriers patrolled by police, their long-snouted cameras poised, their breath rising like steam. Snow fell steadily onto hats and shoulders. Gloved fingers wiped lenses clear. From time to time there came outbreaks of desultory clicking as the watchers filled the waiting time by snapping the white canvas tent in the middle of the road, the entrance to the tall red brick apartment block behind it, and the balcony on the top floor from which the body had fallen. Behind the tightly packed paparazzi stood white vans with enormous satellite dishes on the roofs and journalists talking, some in foreign languages, while sound men in headphones hovered. Between recordings, the reporters stamped their feet and warmed their hands on hot beakers of coffee from the teeming cafe a few streets away. To fill the time, the woolly-hatted cameramen filmed the backs of the photographers, the balcony, the tent concealing the body, then repositioned themselves for wide shots that encompassed the chaos that had exploded inside the sedate and snowy Mayfair Street, with its lines of glossy black doors framed by white stone porticos and flanked by topiary shrubs. The entrance to number 18 was bounded with tape. Police officials, some of them white-clothed forensic experts, could be glimpsed in the hallway beyond. The television stations had already had the news for several hours. Members of the public were crowding at either end of the road, held at bay by more police. Some had come on purpose to look. Others had paused on their way to work. Many held mobile telephones aloft to take pictures before moving on. One young man, not knowing which was the crucial balcony, photographed each of them in turn, even though the middle one was packed with a row of shrubs, three neat leafy orbs, which barely left room for a human being. A group of young girls had brought flowers and were filmed handing them to the police, who as yet had not decided on a place for them, but laid them self-consciously in the back of the police van, aware of camera lenses following their every move. The correspondence sent by 24-hour news channels kept up a steady stream of comment and speculation around the few sensational facts that they knew. From a penthouse apartment around 2 o'clock in the morning, police were alerted by the building security guard. No sign yet that they were moving the body, which has led to some to speculate. No word on whether she was alone when she fell. Teams have entered the building and will be conducting a thorough search. A chilly light filled the interior of the tent. Two men were crouching beside the body, ready to move it, at last, into a body bag. Her head had bled a little into the snow. The face was crushed and swollen, one eye reduced to a pucker, the other showing as a sliver of dull white between distended lids. When the sequined top she wore glittered in slight changes of light, it gave the disquieting impression of movement, as though she breathed again, or was tensing muscles, ready to rise. The snow fell with soft fingertip plunks on the canvas overhead. "Where is the bloody ambulance?" Detective Inspector Roy Carver's temper was mounting. A paunchy man with the face the colour of corned beef, whose shirts were usually ringed with sweat around the armpits, his short supply of patience had been exhausted hours ago. He had been here nearly as long as the corpse. His feet were so cold that he could no longer feel them, and he was lightheaded with hunger. "Ambulance is 2 minutes away," said Detective Sergeant Eric Wardle, unintentionally answering his superior's question as he entered the tent with his mobile pressed to his ear. "Just been organising a space for it." Carver grunted. His bad temper was exacerbated by the conviction that Wardle was excited by the presence of the photographers. Boyishly good-looking, with thick, wavy brown hair, now frosted with snow, Wardle had, in Carver's opinion, dawdled on their few forays outside the tent. "At least that lot will shift once the body's gone," said Wardle, still looking out at the photographers. "They won't go while we're still treating the place like a fucking murder scene," snapped Carver. Wardle did not answer the unspoken challenge. Carver exploded anyway. The poor cow jumped. There was no one else there. Your so-called witness was coked out of her. It's coming, said the Wardle. And to Carver's disgust, he slipped back out of the tent to wait for the ambulance in full sight of the cameras. The story forced news of politics, wars and disasters aside, and every version of it sparkled with pictures of the dead woman's flawless face, her lithe and sculpted body. Within hours, the few known facts that had spread like a virus to millions. The public row with the famous boyfriend, the journey home alone, the overheard screaming and the final fatal fall. The boyfriend fled into a rehab facility, but the police remained inscrutable. Those who had been with her on the evening before her death were hounded. Thousands of columns of newsprint were filled, and hours of television news, and the woman who swore she had overheard a second argument moments before the body fell became briefly famous too, and was awarded smaller-sized photographs beside the images of the beautiful dead girl. But then, to an almost audible groan of disappointment, the witness was proven to have lied, and she retreated into rehab, and the famous prime suspect emerged as the man and the lady in a weather house who could never be outside at the same time. So it was suicide after all, and after a moment's stunned hiatus, the story gained a weak second wind. They wrote that she was unbalanced, unstable, unsuited to the superstardom her wildness and her beauty had snared, that she had moved among an immoral, moneyed class that had corrupted her, that the decadence of her new life had unhinged an already fragile personality. She became a morality tale stiff with schadenfreude, and so many columnists made allusion to Icarus that Private Eye ran a special column. And then, at last, the frenzy wore itself into stillness, and even the journalists had nothing left to say, but that too much had been said already. 3 months later. Part 1. Nam in omni adversitate fortunae, infelicissimum et genus infortuni, fuisse felicem. For in every ill turn of fortune, the most unhappy sort of unfortunate man is the one who has been happy. Boethius, De Consolatione Philosophiae. Chapter 1. Though Robin Ellicott's 25 years of life had seen their moments of drama and incident, she had never before woken up in the certain knowledge that she would remember the coming day for as long as she lived. Shortly after midnight, her long-term boyfriend, Matthew, had proposed to her under the statue of Eros in the middle of Piccadilly Circus. In the giddy relief following her acceptance, he confessed that he had been planning to pop the question in the Thai restaurant where they had just eaten dinner, but that he had reckoned without the silent couple beside them, who had eavesdropped on their entire conversation. He had therefore suggested a walk through the darkening streets, in spite of Robin's protests that they both needed to be up early, and finally inspiration had seized him, and he had led her, bewildered, to the steps of the statue. There, flinging discretion to the chilly wind, in a most un-Matthew-like way, he had proposed, on one knee, in front of three down-and-outs huddled on the steps, sharing what looked like a bottle of Metz. It had been, in Robin's view, the most perfect proposal ever in the history of matrimony. He even had a ring in his pocket, which she was now wearing. A sapphire with two diamonds. It fitted perfectly, and all the way into town she kept staring at it on her hand as it rested on her lap. She and Matthew had a story to tell now, a funny family story, the kind you told your children, in which his planning, she loved that he had planned it, went awry and turned into something spontaneous. She loved the tramps and the moon and Matthew, panicky and flustered on one knee. She loved Eros and dirty old Piccadilly and the black cab they had taken home to Clapham. She was, in fact, not far off loving the whole of London, which she had not so far warmed to during the month that she had lived there. Even the pale and pugnacious commuter squashed into the tube carriage around her were gilded by the radiance of the ring, and as she emerged into the chilly March daylight at Tottenham Court Road underground station, she stroked the underside of the platinum band with her thumb and experienced an explosion of happiness at the thought that she might buy some bridal magazines at lunchtime. Male eyes lingered on her as she picked her way through the roadworks at the top of Oxford Street, consulting a piece of paper in her right hand. Robin was, by any standards, a pretty girl. Tall and curvaceous, with long strawberry blonde hair that rippled as she strode briskly along, the chill air adding colour to her pale cheeks. This was the first day of a week-long secretarial assignment. She had been temping ever since coming to live with Matthew in London, though not for much longer. She had what she termed proper interviews lined up now. The most challenging part of these uninspiring piecemeal jobs was often finding the offices. London, after the small town in Yorkshire she had left, felt vast, complex and impenetrable. Matthew had told her not to walk around with her nose in an A to Z, which would make her look like a tourist and render her vulnerable. She therefore relied, as often as not, on pearly handwritten maps that somebody at the temping agency had made for her. She was not convinced that this made her look more like a native-born Londoner. The metal barricades and the blue plastic Coramec walls surrounding the roadworks made it much harder to see where she ought to be going, because they obscured half the landmarks drawn on the paper in her hand. She crossed the torn-up road in front of a towering office block labelled Centre Point on her map, which resembled a gigantic concrete waffle with its dense grid of uniform square windows, and made her way in the rough direction of Denmark Street. She found it almost accidentally, following a narrow alleyway called Denmark Place out into a short street full of colourful shop fronts, windows full of guitars, keyboards and every kind of musical ephemera. Red and white barricades surrounded another open hole in the road, and workmen in fluorescent jackets greeted her with early morning wolf whistles, which Robin pretended not to hear. She consulted her watch. Having allowed her usual margin of time for getting lost, she was a quarter of an hour early. The nondescript black painted doorway of the office she sought stood to the left of the 12-bar cafe. The name of the occupant of the office was written on a scrappy piece of lined paper sellotaped beside the buzzer for the second floor. On an ordinary day, without the brand new ring glittering upon her finger, she might have found this off-putting. Today, however, the dirty paper and the peeling paint of the door were, like the tramps from last night, mere picturesque details in the backdrop of her grand romance. She checked her watch again. The sapphire glittered and her heart leapt. She would watch that stone glitter all the rest of her life. Then decided, in a burst of euphoria, to go up early and show herself keen for a job that did not matter in the slightest. She had just reached for the bell when the black door flew open from the inside and a woman burst out onto the street. For one strangely static second, the two of them looked directly into each other's eyes, as each braced to withstand a collision. Robin's senses were usually receptive on this enchanted morning. The split-second view of what that white face made such an impression on her that she thought, moments later, when they had managed to dodge each other, missing contact by a centimetre, after the dark woman that had hurried off down the street, around the corner and out of sight, that she could have drawn her perfectly from memory. It was not merely the extraordinary beauty of the face that had impressed itself on her memory, but the other's expression, livid, yet strangely exhilarated. Robin caught the door before it closed on the dingy stairwell. An old-fashioned metal staircase spiralled up around an equally antiquated birdcage lift. Concentrating on keeping her high heels from catching in the metalwork stairs, she proceeded to the first landing, passing a door carrying a laminated and framed poster saying Crowdy Graphics, and continued climbing. It was only when she reached the glass door on the floor above that Robin realised for the first time what kind of business she had been sent to assist. Nobody at the agency had said. The name on the paper beside the outside buzzer was engraved on the glass panel, C.B. Strike, and underneath it, the words, Private Detective. Robin stood quite still, with her mouth slightly open, experiencing a moment of wonder that nobody who knew her could have understood. She had never confided in a solitary human being, even Matthew, her lifelong, secret, childish ambition. For this to happen today, of all days, it felt like a wink from God, and this too she somehow connected with the magic of the day, with Matthew and the ring, even though, properly considered, they had no connection at all. Savouring the moment, she approached the engraved door very slowly. She stretched out her left hand, sapphire dark now in this dim light, towards the handle. But before she had touched it, the glass door, too, flew open. This time there was no near miss. 16 unseeing stone of dishevelled mail slammed into her. Robin was knocked off her feet and catapulted backwards, handbag flying, arms windmilling, towards the void beyond the lethal staircase.